Hi, everybody. It's nice to see some friendly and familiar faces and some new faces to me. Linda gave me a pretty good introduction. I guess what I'm going to talk about tonight, what'd you say, Linda, 20 minutes? Is that right? About? Okay, well, I mean with questions, but okay. There's two kinds of data that we really want teachers looking at. One is what I, the technical term for it is what I call big data, the stuff that happens once a year, like the state MCAs. And then there's the little data, which is really the more useful data to teachers. It's sort of the data that they use for monitoring the progress of kids during the year to see if they're making progress towards those big year-end goals on the big data. So we're not really going to talk much about the little data today, but recognize that a lot of the work that Woodland has been doing and that makes it so innovative within the district and within the state is their use of little data to inform their practice. Right? So they're not waiting till the end of the year to find out whether or not something's working instructionally. They're checking in once a month. They're checking in every couple weeks. And for the kids who are struggling, they've got strategies in place to respond to that and strategies in place to collectively look at that data and say, well, what do we do about this kid or these group of kids who's struggling, who is not making it. And so one of the reasons people keep coming to Woodland to see is because from that process is working really well, and Woodland is ahead of the other districts. So, I mean, the other schools in the district. So on Friday, when Rick and Becky Dufour, who are sort of some of our national data-driven decision-making gurus, who go around the country and get paid huge bucks to talk to schools about how to use data for school improvement, and, you know, a lot of the teachers at Woodland were coming up to Linda afterward and goes, oh, so that's why we're doing that. Or, you know, teachers and principals from other schools were coming up and saying, you know, it's a validation of the fact that Woodland is ahead and now we need to catch up. And so there's a lot of really good stuff going on here that I think from a process standpoint doesn't get recognized too much by the parent community. So I just want to point that out. It's been fun. Now, tonight we're going to talk about big data. So we're going to talk, as Linda's mentioned, we're going to talk about the MCAs. We're also going to talk about the NWA results. Because our kids take those too, and we're going to start it all off with some overview of the demographic changes that have been happening in the school. I think it's hard for us as parents sometimes to really keep track of sort of the changes that this school has been through since it opened. And you know, my kids started here a year after the school opened, and some of you have been here for the whole haul. And as you know, this place is a lot different and looks a lot different than it did before. So we're going to talk about some demographic stuff, MCAs, NWA, and then we'll answer questions and do discussion, et cetera. And as well as Linda and I worked together, we didn't work well enough together this evening to make sure you had copies of this. But we're recording my audio, and I will have the slides and audio available on the Woodland website so you can access both of those, both me talking and the slides, at a later date. So sit back, relax, have some coffee, enjoy the ride as we talk about data, really fun stuff here. First of all, enrollment is up, up, up. Demographics are way different than they used to be, and we'll do a little bit of comparison of Woodland to the rest of the district. Those are enrollment numbers for the last 4 years.
Currently at
901 now. Okay, and cruising. So as you can see, Woodland is almost at capacity. We opened below capacity, but you can just see that just from a sheer numbers standpoint, we got a lot more kids and families cruising through the building. Our population looks a little different than it used to. So for example, here's our minority percentage. These are non-white students in the building, and you can see that when we opened in 2003, we were about 38%. We're up now to about 45-46%, so that's climbing every year. We're an increasingly non-white school. From a free and reduced lunch standpoint, which is this line here, you can see that our percentage of students who are on free and reduced lunch, which means that they're living in poverty, have grown from 12 to almost 20%. We're moving up in that way. The special ed line is fairly flat, the green line. You notice that we have about the same percentage of special ed kids as we've had in the past. But our ELL population is growing quite a bit. So in 2004, we had almost no ELL kids, and we're already up pushing 10%, and that also is a significantly growing population of Woodland. From an overall change standpoint, if you look back from 2003, you can see just how different is it. You can see that, for example, our minority population has almost doubled. We're 90% more than we had in 2003. You know, we have almost 365% more ELL kids than we used to. So although they're only 10% of the population, they're a much greater percentage in terms of growth than any other group. our special ed kids have gone up again by half. You can see that our poverty numbers have more than doubled. Our Asian numbers have more than doubled. And of course, a lot of kids occupy more than one of these categories, right? They're both Asian and free and reduced lunch and ELL, for example. So you can just see that this is not a white middle class school. This is a diverse, interesting, challenging school.
Is this information shared with the site council as well?
They've seen much of this. They're going to see the MCA information.
Yes. We're doing a subset of the stuff that the teachers saw at the beginning of the year. So they saw 105 slides. I think we whittled yours down to like 20 to 30. So you're welcome. Well, because we went into more detail grade by grade, for example. Just to sort of compare Woodland to the district, you can see that here's the district average for minority population up top. So you can see that the district has gone from being 30% minority to about 40% minority over the last 3 years. And Woodland has sort of mirrored that change. Our line is roughly parallel to the district line. And we have a higher minority population in general than the district, than the average school in the district does. Okay.
Is there a growth in certain grade levels? Because I was in school for 6 years.
I think a couple years ago we saw sort of a wave that hit sort of fifth, sixth grade. Is that right? So, but now I think we're sort of permeated all grade levels. So.
Our bigger classrooms are bigger numbers. Some of the classrooms
are
1 to 6 years, K through 3.
Yeah.
K through 2, 6 classrooms.
This is the free and reduced lunch line, and you can see again that Woodland is below the district average in terms of kids who are eligible for free reduced lunch, but that again our line mirrors the trend of the district, so the district line is going up, Woodland is also going up. So we have increasing numbers of economically disadvantaged families that we're serving. English language learners, the dark blue line is the district, you can see a mild increase from 8 to almost 10% and then back down to around 9. Woodland, of course, has jumped sharply so that where they used to be well below the district average, they're now at the district average. And that's just been within the last couple years. You can see how steep that fuchsia line is. Special education, again, both have been relatively flat. Osseo has gone up a little bit. We've remained about the same overall. So that's sort of demographic changes that we're seeing. The demographic changes are important because, unfortunately, in American society, with diversity typically also comes lower achievement, right? We still haven't solved the racial achievement gaps. We still haven't solved the poverty achievement gaps. We still haven't solved the special ed achievement gaps or the English language learner achievement gaps that we see throughout American society, not just in our district. And so as we work to address those learning issues, we have increasing number of kids who come in the building who not only look different, but they're also achieving differently than the sort of traditional Caucasian middle class kid, which also constitutes a huge chunk of this school. And you will see that bear fruit in terms of the results of NWA a little later in this presentation. The MCA results came out in November, which is super useful, that's sarcastic, because we took the test back in May, right? And one of the things to remember about the MCAs is that they're really supposed to be a benchmark to sort of check where your kids are once a year. It's sort of what we call a summative assessment. It lets you know sort of in a broad picture, how are we doing? But it doesn't really help the classroom teachers at all in terms of day-to-day classroom instruction and day-to-day classroom improvement. Because the data they get isn't fine-grained enough, like they don't get enough detail in the data from the state to let them know what to work on, either for themselves or for their kids. You know, so like they'll get the state writing test, and the school will get, well, your average is 3.2. Well, great, 3.2. What does that tell us? Well, it tells us that 3 was passing, so that's good. But does it tell us like what to work on with kids on their writing? No. Because we don't get any substrands, they don't break out that thing. It doesn't tell us, for example, where a ton of the kids right at the 3 to 3.2 range, where up, you know, how many 4s and 5s we have. They don't get any of that. So the MCA results are really limited in terms of what we get. The other thing that's important to note is that they're much harder this year than they have been before. So the MCA2s are much more difficult than they used to be. Yes?
The
state says that because of the limited number of questions that are on the state exam, that when you start breaking it out into subcategories, that there's not enough questions in each area to be statistically valid. And from a psychometric statistical standpoint, they may be right. But from a utility standpoint, in terms of are these scores giving us any useful information, it gives us nothing.
And if there's a security piece, do they come sealed? Kids have to break them open, the teachers can't see what's inside, and when the kids are done taking the test, they have to reseal the test. So a teacher really doesn't, unless you walk around the room and teach, you really don't see what the test is.
Right.
And I'm sure you'll cover this, but I don't understand what the benefit is then. I mean, if you're not giving any answers to why there's a problem, how do you fix the problem?
Exactly.
Oh.
Right, because the point of the scores is to hold schools accountable, right? So by setting a high standard and saying that we want all kids to achieve that, and then making all the schools work hard to get their kids up to that level, that, you know, all kids will be better prepared for college. And that's really what we're seeing here with the increasing difficulty of the MCAs, is that we're seeing a ratcheting up of the expectation level for where kids should be in terms of achievement, because there was a perception from colleges and universities and the workforce that when kids were leaving high school, they weren't ready for college, they weren't ready to go into the workforce, etc. So the state's response to that was to up the expectation of what do we expect kids to know and be able to do when they leave 12th grade. So if the score was here, now we're going to make it here. Right, and this will be where we think kids ought to be in order to be ready for college and ready to enter the workforce. And then what they did is they filtered that down grade by grade to say sort of, okay, well in third grade we'll nudge that up a bit, in fourth grade a little more, in fifth grade a little more, until eventually we catch up to that higher target rather than the lower target we had before. But the thing to recognize is that that cut score is arbitrary in the sense that it's set politically. It doesn't represent any kind of agreed-upon standard of proficiency. It's not like you got a bunch of educational scientists together, or professors, or assessment experts, and said, this is what a kid really needs to know. It's this score represents this kind of skill and knowledge. It's just really a bunch of people sitting around the table and said, well, how high should it be? Yes?
So the high school senior has to pass this class, and then they're just going to be important. And if they don't pass it, they're
right. So it's sort of replacing the... Correct. Remember, we elected the people who set the system up.
Yeah.
So.
And they have to raise the bar every year.
Right.
So test scores are raised every year because right. The goal of NIFLBE, No Child Left Behind, federal legislation is that by the year 2014, all children will meet the benchmark.
Right.
So every year it's going to get closer to every kid having to have 100%.
Right. And we're really seeing a 2.5-decade movement around accountability and standards and assessments. So in 1983, this report came out called A Nation at Risk that basically just attacked American education, said we weren't preparing kids for the workforce, we're falling behind Japan, blah, blah, blah. Remember back when Japan was a competitor, et cetera. And so that's when we started saying, like, okay, well, kids will now, they must take 3 years of math instead of two. They must take 4 years of English instead of three. We want every kid to have at least 2 years of a foreign language. All that kind of stuff happened, and we started requiring state standards. We started requiring testing to those standards, et cetera. And so what had been in place at the time was a lot of states had what they called minimum competency tests, where we said, here's some basic floor of information that we want kids to have when they leave high school. You know, things like, you know, can you read a pill bottle? Can you navigate a street sign without killing somebody? Just some basic functional skills so that you go out and live in the world without, you know, killing yourself or others or whatever. But then over time, they started saying, well, that's too low. We've set the floor too low. Our expectations for kids are too low. If we want to be competitive in the global workplace, we have to have higher expectations for our kids. So, you know, we're Pennsylvania. We're going to set our bar here. Then Ohio goes, well, we're Ohio, not Pennsylvania. We're going to set our bar here. And then New York goes, well, on Ohio and Pennsylvania, we're going to set our bar here. And the next thing you know, Virginia, the first time it gave its statewide test, 91% of its kids failed it because of the political ratcheting, right? And so, again, there's not really a good sense of, the cut scores don't mean anything in terms of educational performance per se. What they are is a bunch of people sitting around a table, both parties, and hacking out, what should the line be? What do we think the line should be in terms of, you know, it's supposed connection to workplace readiness and college readiness. Yes, most non-educators. Okay, so how do we do last year? And I'm not even showing historical data because there's no way to compare previous year's MCA results with this year's MCA results. They're completely different tests, completely different scoring systems. The best place to look at it is to really just say, hey, did we meet our target? What percentage of our kids made the target? And you can see Woodland is doing pretty well. If you look at all of our kids, if this is the target that we're trying to meet, we can see that we went well above that. Right, so we've got 85%, 84% or so that met the target on MCA reading overall. Now, as you break that into subgroups, you can see that different groups have had different levels of success. So Asian kids above the target, African-American kids above the target, white kids well above the target. Our English language learners, that's LEP, limited English proficiency, they're above the target. This green bar here is free and reduced lunch. And then these are our special ed kids. And as you can see, our special ed kids did not meet the target, but they had enough growth and they were close enough that they're under what we call safe harbor, which means that we won't count it against the school this year, but we might in future years. That's the idea. So that's reading. Okay. In math, you can see similar results. All kids strongly above the target, Asian kids above the target, African American kids just above the target, white kids strongly above the target, English language learners above the target, special ed kids below but in safe harbor, they met with an alternative target, free and reduced lunch. The free and reduced lunch line is right here and we're just that close, so it's just, you know, almost but not quite, but close enough. All right, so essentially we're doing okay. You can see that the populations that we're struggling with are our poor kids, our students with special needs, and our English language learners. And one of the things we know, of course, is that our English language learner population has skyrocketed in the last couple years compared to what it used to be. Our free and reduced lunch population has gone up significantly. So we have very different kids than we had just a couple years ago. And so what this teaching staff is dealing with, it's dealing with new populations and more of them. And they're trying to figure out, how do we adjust our teaching strategies? You know, how do we interact with families of different cultures that we may not have interacted with before, et cetera? And how do we work along these new paradigms to have all of our kids be successful? So that's sort of what we're working through right now. Now, just to help you understand what the MCA score raising does to the passage rate for schools, is I'm going to give you an example here. We're all sort of familiar with this idea of the bell curves. Like, for example, we lined us all up by height. You have short people, you'd have tall people, and it's kind of the bulge in the middle where you had a bunch of people at 5'5", 5'4", 5'6", you know, and then as we get closer to 6 feet, there's fewer of us. As we get closer to 5 feet, there's fewer of us. And similarly, with any kind of wide range of performance, like a bunch of kids with test scores, you're going to see that bell curve where you have a few kids at the low end, a few kids at the high end, this big bulge of kids in the middle, right? It just kind of goes up like a big hill and back down again, right? And so kind of this shape. Now, because we haven't yet solved the black-white achievement gap issue, for whatever reason, that even when you have two curves that are relatively the same, so maybe you have a curve of white kids and a curve of African-American kids, the black curve gets shifted that way, which means that their average score is lower. Okay? So sort of if you bisected the middle of the hill, you would see that the average score for the black kids, right in the middle of the big lump, is to the left of the average score for the white kids, and that represents that achievement gap. So we say, for example, that black kids right now are performing at about 85% of the level of white kids on standardized assessments. So by definition, that curve is shifted slightly to the left, which just means that their average is in a different place. All right. Now, let's say that we put a cut score right here, right down the middle, right through the middle of the white curve. Okay. Well, then by definition, the black kids are shifted over to the left. And what you can see is that anybody to the right of the cut score, those are the proficient kids. So by definition, the white kids are like half, right? Because we put the cut score right down the middle. But because the black curve is shifted left, it's this slice right here that's above. Because there's still more kids to get over to half that haven't made it to the cut score yet. Everybody with me? All right. So what that means is when you put the cut score at the overall average of all the kids, which is pretty close to the white middle, and the black kids represent exactly half of the population, so those curves are about the same height, they have about the same number of kids under them, is that, you know, over 50% of the white kids are proficient, and only 20% of the black kids are proficient. Again, that's, you know, just over 50% here of the white curve, but only that part right here represents only 20% of the overall black curve. Okay? So that's what we're seeing when we just set the cut score right down the middle of the entire group. 50th percentile average point. Now, what if we move the cut score up, make it harder to pass the test? We don't move the curves any. They're still achieving exactly the same as they have. But just by moving it up, notice that fewer kids in both curves now are to the right of that line. Right? But more kids in the white curve are across that line because the white curve was shifted over to the right relative to the black curve in the first place. Right? So the white percentage of kids that makes the cut score is that much. And the black percentage of kids that make the score is just that little wedge right there. And when you do that, when you're assuming that the white kids and the black kids are each 50% of the population, just by moving the cut score over, instead of having, you know, 55% of the white kids and 20% of the black kids proficient, just by moving the cut score over, changing nothing else, which is what happened this year, now all of a sudden you have 17% of the white kids proficient and about 1% of the black kids proficient. Just by moving the score. One sec. Now, what's more likely is the black kids actually aren't half our population. They're typically less than that, like 15%, which means that the curve is smaller. And notice that when you do that, now the only percentage of the kids that are under that little edge is a little bit down here. So it's like even less than that 1% now. It's like a tenth of 1%, where the white kids are still the same. So just by mirroring a more accurate population distribution, say for the district, and moving that cut score over, just moving that cut score can have dramatic differences on the percentage of kids that pass. Right? So when all of a sudden this wave of high schools in Minnesota gets put on the AYP list, their kids aren't doing any differently than they did before. The only thing that shifted was the line move. Right? Now we have fewer kids to the right of that line, and that's what we're seeing. Yes?
My question is, what can we do as parents to improve these tests?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, obviously, this is
right. Well, it is for a purpose. It represents, I mean, the state believes it represents a consensus of a high expectation for kids so that they're ready for college and work. So it does not make sense from a trying to get data to teachers for improvement standpoint. We would hope. But often you need different scores and different tests for those two goals.
Piggyback off that, how would a PTA like ours help the school and the exams and all the teachers that are here? Because the general rule, and maybe it's in this test, you know, it's the school's responsibility. The parents aren't going to do the extra work.
Right.
We may have a small percentage to do that.
Yep.
But it's not my problem.
Right. Well, I mean, it seems to me that if you're concerned about this issue, if you're concerned about the misalignment of scores with instructional purpose, if you think that the scores aren't useful and we should be putting more energy into scores that are useful and assessments that are useful, the thing that you can do, of course, is A, help our community recognize how this all works. Right, so we don't just get people who lived in gut reaction looking at the scores and go, oh, well, they're doing a terrible job. You know, they used to be on the list, now they're in danger. I mean, they were solidly not on the list, now they're in danger of being on the list. You know, what's happening there? They're sliding, you know, per diems, and those teachers, they don't know what they're doing. You know, it's time for a change. We need to help the community understand what the scores mean and what they don't mean and what they tell us and how they're useful and not useful, and that's definitely a role of the PTA. Another role, of course, would be around lobbying and political influence, right? Talking to your local representatives, talking to folks in the state who have involvement in this process, and asking them pointed questions about, you know, do you really think this is working for Minnesota? Do you really think this is working for our kids? Why aren't we getting teachers information that's more useful to them on a day-to-day classroom instruction standpoint, et cetera? I mean, that's the other piece, it seems to me. And use all of our other lobbying and political influences that we have to make whatever desired changes you have. Yes?
Can we have Scott? I mean, I'm sure none of us knew this. I mean, can we have a special presentation and put it out in one of our Wednesday mails saying, you know, if you have any questions as to what you read in the paper about, you know, our scores being, you know, horrible or whatever, we have somebody that will come in and explain it one night. Can we do something like that? Because it makes a little more sense. than what they see in the paper. That's what
they
tonight.
Right.
Right, but they have,
yes, right.
But I think the average, I didn't realize how these numbers were.
Right. I mean,
we can establish, as a staff, we can establish this test as our baseline because this is the first year of testing. And now what are we going to do to assure that our kids get it? And how much, and that's that way, how much do you put into this test so you pass? Because we're in a, we're in what's called Safe Harbor. We were a Title I school and didn't meet our goals. We would be put into not making annual yearly progress. We'd have to write all kinds of plans. We'd have to tell our kids could transfer to other schools. We'd be deemed a not quality school. Well, that's not true. Just because 40 special ed kids didn't make the goal, we can't judge a whole school by that. But that's what they're doing to Title I schools. And then if 3 or 4 years into that, the school doesn't meet the goal, they're, we're getting to where next year, I think, they'll go into the entire school, fire the principal and the teachers, move them all around the district, and bring in an entire new staff, and it'll be run by a corporation, basically.
It could be.
Could be.
Oh, right.
So, if you're a Title I school, we're not, so it doesn't mean anything except bad press for our school. If that's what's helping people understand that you really can't judge Woodland or any school by what, by the results of the test.
Right.
Do we have things to work on? Yeah, we don't want a gap between our black kids and our, you know, why are English language learners performing better than our black kids? Who don't necessarily, some have language, they're from Liberia or Nigeria or Africa. But we have some questions we have to answer the staff because we want all kids to be proficient, but...
Right, and actually, because of the processes that Woodland has in place and has been working on for the last few years, there's sort of a pack of schools at the top of the district in terms of achievement. It's a group of 7 to 8 schools that they sort of clump together around achievement. And Woodland has consistently been sort of in the bottom of that top third. So, you know, usually, depending on what you're looking at, they're number six school in the district, number 7 school in the district, number 8 school in the district. But if you look at the populations that those schools serve, a lot of them look nothing like white, nothing like Woodland. They're very white, they're very affluent. You know, they have like 2% kids on free lunch, not, you know, 25, right? No special ed kids, you know, no ELL kids. And then, so what? One of the things we did this summer was we did a gap analysis where we said, all right, let's look at, for example, the white-black achievement gap in Woodland, and let's compare it to other schools' white-black achievement gap that had enough kids to count, right? So we might look, and out of those 8 schools, 3 of them have enough kids to count, right? And of those 3, Woodland would have the smallest black-white achievement gap. It has a gap, so it's not happy about that, but it's got the smallest gap of the 3. Then we look at ELL, and we say, all right, there's 3 schools that have enough ELL kids to count. Guess who has the lowest ELL gap? Woodland. You know, so we're finding those kind of things, is that the processes are working. We're not there yet. We've still got gaps that we're trying to close, but our gaps are smaller than other places. And it's because of the processes that the teachers have in place. But when we see a shift like this, where all of a sudden we go from 85% proficient to 64% proficient, you know, stuff like that, it tells us nothing, because our kids aren't doing any differently, right? They didn't get stupider all of a sudden. So it's just that they literally move the cut score over, so now fewer people are above it. And I think, you know, this sort of shows that quite dramatically. Here are the correlations within the district. So, for example, here is the correlation between math performance and ELL. Right, yeah, the state calls it limited English proficient, right. So what does a correlation mean? Well, a correlation means that correlations can range from +1 to -1. A +1 means that every time you have this other thing always shows up. So for example, when it gets really hot in the summer, the correlation between the temperature outside and the number of people wearing shorts and sandals, very high, right, like 0.9. the percentage, the correlation as the temperature goes up and the percentage of people wearing snow boots and parkas is almost inverse, right? The higher the temperature goes up, the fewer people wearing parkas and boots, except for a couple crazy people. So pretty much that correlation is almost perfect, but it's an opposite direction. It's a negative correlation, so it would be like negative 0.9, all right? So when one thing shows up in the presence of another, that's a positive correlation. When one thing disappears as another thing increases, that's a negative correlation. But notice that a positive correlation of 1 is just as strong as a negative correlation of negative 1. It's just different direction. So no correlation, no relationship, like the relationship between the temperature outside and how many people like to eat broccoli is probably close to 0. Okay? It would be very hard to articulate a relationship there. So as we look at the relationships here, we can see that as LEP, as English language learners go up, math performance goes down. That's a negative relationship. So the more ELL learners you have, the lower the math performance is in general, the average math score on the MCA. All right, and that's, and we have ways of categorizing these relationships, and that would be considered a moderate relationship. As the number of special ed kids go up, the math performance is marginally related. It's actually a very weak relationship. We can't really say there's one there at all. So the relationship between math performance and the number of special ed kids you have, almost nothing. However, let's look at math and free lunch. Let's look at math and minority status. The more poor kids you have in your school, the more minority kids you have in your school within the district, the more likely it is that your math score is lower. And those relationships are actually very strong, right? Moderately strong, because they're getting closer and closer to that negative one. Right, the more poor kids you have, the lower the math goes. So those are moderately strong, and these are across all the schools in the district. Similarly for reading, we've got a moderate negative relationship for reading in ELL, just like here. It's even stronger than this one. So there's a stronger relationship between English language learners and reading and lower reading performance than there is English language learners and math performance, and that makes sense because they're English language learners. And we have very strong relationships between reading performance and very strong negative relationships between reading performance and how many free lunch or minority kids you have in the building. So these are the district-wide trends. You can see that the correlation is very strong in some of these areas. The more poor kids you have, the more minority kids you have in the building, the lower the achievement, math or reading. So as Woodlands becomes more diverse, it's mirroring those district-wide trends, and these are actually society-wide trends, not just within the district. Okay, so we're all struggling how to figure out how to meet the needs of kids in poverty, kids of color, kids who are learning English. Yeah.
Scott,
yep.
The lunch and minority pockets of
uh-huh.
the population, you see that they're pretty much the same. So are these correlations pretty much the same for poor kids, or is the math lunch?
That's a good question. I don't know what the overlap is between those two groups.
Woodland is a unique school access to the state of Minnesota in that... We're unique in that almost every school in the state of Minnesota, the poverty ratio and the minority ratio are within 5 percentage points. Woodland, our minority ratio, I think I just got it today, is like 44%.
Right.
And our poverty is 18 or 17.
This one.
Yeah.
Right,
just
so.
Just got December 1.
Minority status, poverty status. So there's a big gap there.
Yeah.
So a lot of these kids are also here, but a lot of them aren't.
Sometimes they're just scared because our pretty reduced, we're an anomaly in that those
right.
are
Those two groups don't overlap as much as they might say, for example, in Minneapolis
sure.
or St. Paul.
Or any other school in our district.
Right. Okay, let's talk about NWAs, which are these other tests that our kids take. We take them in the fall. We take them in the spring. Why do we take a second test? Well, because it gives us better information than the MCAs. A lot of districts have voluntarily gone to the NWAs because, among other things, it gives us substrands. We can actually figure out, like, what area should we work on. It gives a little more detail in that area. It also... helps us, you can do growth from year to year. Like, you can't compare a fourth grade score 1 year to the fifth grade score the next year on the state test. But in NWA, you can. You can literally say the kid grew this much during this year, and of course the goal is to have a year's growth, or at least every year. So just a quick snapshot here. You can see here's the Woodland line, dark blue. This is the average overall reading score for NWA over time. This is the average score for Osseo, and this is the average line for the nation. And across four different springs, this is the sixth grade class of 2006, so this is their score in sixth grade, fifth grade, fourth grade, third grade. This is the same kids over time. It's not four different groups of kids. We're comparing the same kids as they progress through the school. You can see that Woodland kids started out higher and remained higher, and in fact actually increased that gap a little bit. They're actually gaining slightly greater rate than the district as a whole and the nation as a whole. And this one is for just the sixth grade class of 2006, but we see similar patterns for other groups of kids that have gone through with us.
Does this take just an apples to apples in the fact that you have training new kids? Do you have people over enrollment?
Right. No, not always. We may have some new kids here that didn't exist here.
Okay.
So it's not just the kids that have been here all 4 years.
So you may have some kids that, for whatever reason, were in that more affluent white area and came to Woodland because of whatever.
Right, but what we see is that when we take just those kids that have been around 4 years, the line looks very similar. So that actually the mobility hasn't had too much of an effect.
And actually what we see is
on our averages.
Think about a 363% increase in English language learners when this last sixth grade class was in third grade. Despite all the changes in the demographics,
Right. Now that's average score, average reading score. So we may be getting some more diverse kids in who are lower achievers, but we're also getting more higher achievers in. And so what the next line shows us is we have to show us the percentage of kids who are reading above grade level. Our trend line is up. So for example, here's that same sixth grade class. Back when they were in third grade, you know, the blue bar means that slightly less than 50% of kids in third grade were at proficiency. But over time, Woodland increased that number so that it was over 60% by the time they were in sixth grade. Right? So more kids over time are becoming more proficient within that class. So as you follow that group over time, more and more kids become proficient. So that's good. Right? And you can see that our trend line is up, and that's what you want, is you want us making a positive difference on kids. You want more kids being proficient. But the challenge for Woodland has been is that, similarly, the percentage of kids that have been below grade level is also going up. So it's like we're sort of losing the middle. We have the higher achievers, and that group gets bigger. And we have the low achievers, and that group also is getting bigger because of the demographic changes that are occurring within the school. Right? So we're doing a nice job of taking those kids who are already successful and moving them forward and getting kids who are close up over the bar, but we're also having an increasing number of kids who are coming to us who we're still struggling with. As we get more diverse, we haven't figured it out yet, so those numbers also go up. Now the good news, of course, is that the percentage of kids who are above grade level is much higher, 60%, than the percentage of kids who are below grade level, in this case 20%. But nonetheless, notice that both trend lines go up. And that was a real struggle for staff to think about this summer, beginning of the fall, was how can both of those lines be going up simultaneously? Questions?
You know, we even looked at, we have...
Right, because you have increasing numbers. Yeah. Right.
Even though we're not actually performing at grade level. And last year our goal was to move those non-proficient kids to proficiency. And of course you're not going to move all of them.
I'm going to show that.
Our goal is always all... Are you going to show that?
Mm-hmm. Okay. No, just hold that thought. So overall reading proficiency, about 77%, which is actually relatively similar to the MCA numbers. They're fairly close. But we still have about a fourth of Woodland kids who are not at proficient level for NWAs. And you can see that across grade levels, that's fairly consistent, right? So roughly the same percentage of kids is not proficient at each grade level. So last year you can see that just over 20% of second graders weren't proficient, about 18% of third graders. You can see that it's ranging sort of between 17 and 30%. There's not a big variance across grades here in terms of the kids who were proficient, blue, and the percentage of kids who weren't proficient, red. Similarly, when we start breaking that out by other categories like ethnicity, you can see that our Caucasian students, much smaller percentage of kids is not proficient in our Caucasian kids, right? Like about 13% of Caucasian kids are not proficient, but over 30% of African American and Asian kids are non-proficient. And again, it's that thing that we talked about at the beginning, and that diversity, unfortunately, still comes with lower academic achievement. And that's what we're all struggling to figure out. Poverty, same thing. Notice that if you were not eligible for free and reduced lunch, your likelihood of being proficient was over 80%. But if you were eligible for free or reduced lunch, it's almost a 50-50 split. You had a 50-50 chance of either being proficient or not proficient. This camp sort of split almost exactly in half. We've got half of our poor kids at the above proficiency, another half not. So 30 percentage point gap between those two groups. Similarly for special ed, you know, over 80% of the kids who are not eligible for special ed, and you can see that dramatic differences, you know, about a third of the kids in special ed are making proficiency. These are English language learners, same thing, non-English language learners, English language learners, again, those gaps.
Some of that you expect, because
right.
You aren't going to be in special ed unless you're both 2 years behind, and you don't qualify for any special ed unless you're sitting behind of one of you pass that bar, and you no longer are
right.
Considered an English language
exactly.
Learner.
Yeah. These are the splits by boy-girl. Notice that the boys aren't doing quite as well as the girls, but all in all, differences aren't as huge as some of the other categories. Boys over here. Now, this is the interesting one. This is the one that Linda talked about. Now, one of the things they did, one of the strategies that Wilden employed, is that at the beginning of, not this fall, but the previous fall, we said, who are the kids that are not proficient? We want to know at the beginning of the year so we can focus on them the whole year. All right, so these are a variety of test scores to identify a clump of kids in each grade, and we said these kids are non-proficient. These are the kids that we really want to focus on. They're our target group, right? We're going to call them the NP group, the non-proficient group. Those are the kids we want to focus on. And our goal is to move as many of those kids off the non-proficient list as possible in each grade. Then we got the bulk of the school, which are the proficient kids. And of course, we want to keep them proficient. We don't want to lose too many of them to non-proficiency. And that's what you see here. So here are the non-proficient kids. Notice that, let me get this right now. Okay, here are our proficient kids. Notice that we have 435 proficient kids, right? And how many of those kids made proficiency at the end of the year? Almost 90% of them. But we lost some. We lost a small wedge who they were proficient at the beginning of the year based on previous year scores, but this year, for whatever reason, they were not proficient. On the other hand, here's our non-proficient kids, and notice that we moved some of them off, but a lot of them still stayed on the list. So our goal of moving these non-proficient kids off the list into proficiency was met by almost 30%, about a fourth of them. We moved about a fourth of them off the list. But notice that we moved 25 off, but we gained 71. Right? So even though this wedge is smaller, we're moving a greater percentage of this bar off the list than we're moving this part onto the list. This number is larger overall from a sheer numbers standpoint. So we actually lost ground in the sense that as we become more diverse, our achievement continues to struggle. So, and it's not necessarily an issue of growth, because, for example, if you look at the amount of growth that's occurring by these two groups, you can see that the non-proficient kids in third grade have higher growth than the proficient kids. The non-proficient kids in fourth grade have higher growth than the proficient kids. The non-proficient kids in fifth grade had higher growth than the proficient kids. Only in sixth grade do we see a difference, which means that the catch-up strategies in terms of having these kids grow faster so that they can catch up is working. Pretty much across the board. We had something going on in sixth grade, so I'm trying to figure out what's happening there. But for the most part, they're either equal growth or higher growth, so the catch-up strategies are working for the non-proficient kids. But the new non-proficient kids that are coming in are greater than the ones we can move off the list. It's sort of like the I Love Lucy episode, right, where the stuff's coming down the conveyor belt faster than she can box it and eat it and whatever. I mean, that's sort of what's happening here.
But we're not losing the non-proficient kids, right? I mean, that's not...
No, a few. I mean, a few. We had about 12% of kids who were proficient who were not proficient the next year. And a lot of those were probably bubble kids. They could have gone either way. One year they went this way, the other year they went the other way. It's not like we had a bunch of kids up here who went...
In fact, this year we raised our bar quite a bit.
Right.
So we labeled more kids non-proficient.
Yeah.
More kids. We're trying a lot.
And the goal of all of this is that we want these blue bars higher than the burgundy bars, because what we're trying to do is we're trying to close these gaps over time, right? So if this is the gap for last year's sixth graders, way back when they were in third grade, if this is the gap between poor kids and non-poor kids, over time we want those two lines to converge, to come to a point, right? We don't want that gap to continue to exist. You can see right now it is persisting, right? The space between those two lines is staying about the same as they go from third grade to fourth grade to fifth grade to sixth grade. That average achievement gap is still existing, whether it's last year's sixth graders or fifth graders or fourth graders or third graders. So the goal here is to converge those lines together. And that's why Woodland's doing all this data analysis, and they're doing all of this month-to-month stuff. But the demographic changes have been sort of balancing out the academic progress and initiatives and changes that the staff has been making, so it's holding roughly equal right now. And I think that's what we're seeing. Go ahead.
How much transiency is there within the school year? We don't have our mobility percentage.
It's not that high. They're coming in, but they're not leaving. So anyway, so those are the numbers in a nutshell. You know, the trends I showed you hold for other grades and other subjects. That's essentially what we're seeing.
Is this what we're seeing? Like, I look at Park Center and the Maple Grove Senior High.
Yeah.
Huge difference.
Huge difference.
Is this the demographics?
Let me show you the demographics of those two schools. You tell me.
Wow.
I mean, it's very graphic when you see the numbers. Right. So, go ahead.
I'd like to see them.
Sure, absolutely. Okay, so Woodland, PTA.
Why they're looking at those sixth graders that you were looking at. Those are the correct mm-hmm. seventh graders. Those are the first seventh graders that actually have the opportunity to graduate with that new program, too. So they're the marking stone for that.
International baccalaureate.
Yeah, for that. If they choose to go that route.
Right. Okay, so here's Maple Grove. Senior, 39% proficient in math. Park Center, 22% proficient in math. Maple Grove Senior, 77% proficient in reading. Park Center, 45% proficient in reading. Oh, 1 second, sorry, my laptop's acting up here. So we will do this. Okay. Now let's look demographically. Park Center, 12% ELL. Maple Grove Senior, nothing. 8% special ed, 7% roughly equal, 43% poverty, 5% poverty, 60% minority, 9% minority. These are the numbers that should have been published along with the test scores in the local paper. Right, it's all about context. And it's about the continuing struggle of all schools, not just Osseo schools, but all schools nationwide. How do we serve the academic needs of poor kids, of kids of color, kids who are learning English, etc.? So there you have it.
Now that we feel depressed in the way the world is unfolding.
Information is power.
You know, and this, you're absolutely correct, but, you know, We're a PTA group, and there's some folks here who have been here since day one, to your point earlier.
Yep.
You know, and we're trying to make a difference by having Carnegie.
Okay.
And we have $31,000 in the bank, which clearly is not enough. But how do we help a building like this? And I know Denise and I talked about this over the summer, because this kind of coincides with what I was bringing up to you, because you have the history. I don't. I think it's personal. But what do we do? I mean, there's a wealth of parents that are connected here, of which we have maybe 8% connected to the school. I made that up. I think maybe 6 or maybe 12.
Right.
It's absurd. Figure out how to make those monies work and buy projectors and, you know, things like that. I don't know. It's a daunting task.
It's almost overwhelming.
A little bit. Yeah.
I mean, there's
I would agree with that.
Yeah.
Yep.
What can we do? I mean, I know you're calling, I mean, we have volunteer opportunities to come in and read with kids.
And that's why we started at conferences. If you have older kids,
we sit down and tell you where they are with the NWA. We have a chart. We show you where their RIT score is, whether they're proficient or non-proficient, so that our hope is that parents see that their child's non-proficient, they will help support us, because we can't do it alone. If you guys have read my newsletters and my emails, what we've been doing hasn't been working. We got to solicit the whole team, the community, to really, because our goal really is that all kids will be proficient. Are we going to get there? That's probably unrealistic as long as you have ELL and special ed, but doggone it, we're still going to do our darndest to try to get to that goal. So we have to, with our new volunteer coordinator, hopefully we're going to work, you know, we're working on a partnership with St. Teresa's. Joni's been kind of involved in that, and we've got to get more volunteer opportunities going to not only help those kids, the non-proficient, but even enrich those that
is,
are.
Is the district giving guidance as to what that means? Because maybe to some degree the MCA score, okay, we have an issue at hand, but how do we fix it?
Yeah,
I see the Campbell soup thing over here, and I see lunch, and that's great, and that makes my kid feel great.
Is the school district doing it by having open enrollment, and they're trying to make more schools be diversified versus having those, you know, so we spread those kids out to hopefully balance the scores a little bit, or encourage other schools to have to come up with new teaching practices too, and not just make it so that one school has all the challenges or three schools have all the challenges, but make it more district-wide. I mean, is it a lot of that? I mean, I think that's what I see four buses going down our street to the junior high because they've had open enrollment, you know. And, you know, of course, I asked that question, are we going to see four buses going down our street because you've open enrollment? And isn't that going to just make the economy worse? The environment worse because of all the gas you're spending. Oh no, you won't see that. Well, then I see that, you know. But is it better for the kids to have the schools be, all of the schools be more diverse?
You can argue both sides of the coin. I have a friend who is in education now. Her husband's an assistant principal in our district, and she grew up in the projects in New York. And I used to, when we were at Willow Lane, I used to say, I want my kids there, even though we were 60 to 70% poverty. Parents came, we created a community, and she just one time looked at me and said, Linda, until they bus me across to a school that had computers, that had the more experienced teachers, whatever, and kids that had advantages, I was thinking the way my mom lived in poverty and was the way for me, and that opened my door. So there's that view, and then there's the other view that the way the state divvies out resources right now, when I was at Willow Lane, we had a population of about 350 kids, but I would say $450,000 to $500,000 over and above what the district gave us in Title I compensatory at-risk dollars to create programs to meet the needs of the kids of that school. We paid for Rajan out of that money. We paid for tutors. We had, every classroom had at least one para ESP in it supporting kids. Come to Woodland and I think we have $10,000 or $12,000. I mean, so the difference is phenomenal. So if you took all the kids that qualify for free and reduced and spread them amongst our buildings, the resources all also from the state would be spread, well, be minimum. So there are both sides, and I know the magnets are meant to diversify. That's one of the strategies. I don't really know how to answer that. If I were a person of color, I don't think I'd want people talking about moving me and my kids or my kids and me to another school because of our skin color. So I don't know how to answer that.
There's a concept in sociology called the tipping point, which means that white middle-class parents are comfortable with diversity to a certain point, and then all of a sudden it starts to become uncomfortable again. So, you know, you're in your little white middle-class neighborhood, the first family of color moves in, oh great, we're all for diversity, let's welcome to the neighborhood, blah, blah, blah. Second family of color moves in, oh, welcome to the neighborhood, we're all for diversity. That keeps happening. Pretty soon you start looking around and people start going, you know what? It's getting a little too colorful around here. And you move to the next suburb, the next ring out. And that total pattern of white flight, middle class flight out, is exactly what's caused concentration of poverty and color in our urban cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and others. You know, and the fact that we have all these little tiny districts rather than a big countywide system, for example, it's another reflection of white flight. And so it's been a pattern that's been in existence for decades, is that, you know, there's a tipping point where people start saying, I need to move to the next level for whatever reason. You know, they're bringing different culture, you know, I'm a racist. I mean, there's lots of different reasons. But bottom line is it happens. And that percentage is somewhere around 15-20%. Now, some communities can sustain a higher level than that, but on average, it's around 15-20%. So now the question becomes, would the community actually stand for equalization of population burden across schools, right? Let's spread DLL kids across all three high schools rather than concentrating them in one or two. And who's going to holler, of course? The most affluent parents who were in the Lily White affluent school, who say, whoa, wait, what are you talking about here? You know, you're going to bring in more low-achieving kids and hurt the chances of my school, and now we're going to be on the AYP list because you're bringing those kids in, and, you know, the pushback happens, and guess who has the influence?
It's already happened.
Right. But I mean, equalization efforts.
A magnet.
Right. Equalization efforts run into those kind of barriers. So then we try to do voluntary movements. You know, we'll lure you with the magnets. We'll literally pull you with our magnetic force to this school, and they have marginal effect at best.
So, which we're bouncing back and trying to pull you here and keep everybody here.
Since there's really no clear-cut answer as to how to change this, what can we do even individually to help our kids? Just keep working on the reading. Now I'm afraid to see what's going to happen to my kids when they get older. What, you know, God, we got how many years, and then they might not even graduate high school.
Higher, even Maple Grove, 33% of their kids, is that what it was? 23%?
Oh yeah, when you pull that.
I mean, even Osseo, I don't think the state could stand. I think if we had YZ scores, it was like 51.
Yeah.
So for 49% of their seniors not to graduate, there's going to have to be some kind of attention to that. And
yeah,
part of it, too, what my husband says anyway, he's principal at Osseo Senior, and he says that the MCAs have, when they get to the high school level, there are two looks. One is for the building-wide state look of whether or not kids are proficient, but then they interpret them a different way, Scott, for the basic standards. They're two cut scores, or they're going to be two cut scores, so they don't know what it's going to look like, but there'll be a graduation cut score that's different than the other cut score. So that may change down the road, but I think there's going to be a public outcry.
Well, as a follow-up then, too, can we change? Can we help? Do we go to board meet or school board meetings? Is it the elected officials? What do we do to help?
School board is not going to be the
Department of Education.
No, I mean, part of it is trying to influence our state legislators.
Okay.
To look at this with a critical eye and say, are these really the kind of assessments that we want on a statewide basis? Are they really helpful to schools? Are they accomplishing what we want to accomplish for our kids? A more localized level, it becomes a question of how best to support Woodland.
Right.
Right? And of course, one is, of course, to keep working with your own kid.
Right.
Another is to help support and elicit support and help other people understand the initiatives where, you know, somebody might say, well, why are they focusing so much on those kids who can't speak English? Or, you know, why are they doing this? And you say, well, here's why. You know, and, you know, here's how we can help. And, you know, sort of those kind of things. And I'm not an instructional expert, especially the elementary level. I used to teach eighth grade, you know, the elementary world. I mean, I got little kids, but I don't live in that world. I'm a data guy. I'm a technology guy. I'm a law guy. So, you know, what do we do instructionally to respond to the needs of the kids in this building? We turn to our experts, Linda and the staff, you know, and they can tell you what they need or what they think they need or what they've tried and hasn't worked, so now we're trying this or whatever, right? And sort of my role and what we're trying to do is we're trying to have everybody get good information flow to themselves so they can see whatever they try, can they tell them whether or not it's working so that they can adjust and modify approaches along the way. And that's really where Woodlands, one of Woodlands' key strengths is that they have their process down better than any other school in the district in terms of having good information flow to themselves about what's working, what isn't.
And that's for the math facts. You know, we want every child to learn their math facts, and we test them on a twice a trimester basis. And then Scott's created a template so teachers can put the student scores in that, in the template, and then we can graph and we can see how kids are doing, and we can, you know, like for instance, the fifth grade kids, when they reach proficiency 2 months in a row, they get to go over to Nick and Willie's and make their own pizzas four at a time, and trying to create some incentives and some reasons. But the other thing we really have to, as a school, we have to look at, and one of the goals I have this year is that we're going to start looking at more of an intervention. It's called a pyramid of interventions. What do you do here? What do you do here? And that's where we're going to need parent support because we can't do it alone. And then, I lost my other train of thought. But we're really going to work to move those kids. And we set benchmarks. You know, this seems to be a score that says they'll be successful when they take the test in 8th or 9th grade. And if they aren't at this benchmark, then we need to do something else to get them there. We're trying to communicate that. So if your child comes home and doesn't know their math facts or computation, help them learn. Because, you know, the bottom line, what we learned is when you go to take the math test, if you don't have those computations or those math facts down, you might know the process, but if you make stupid mistakes, it doesn't matter in the end, because it's going to be counted wrong.
Right.
And so the faster the kids know that, and the same comes with reading fluency and trying to have kids read. We don't want them to read faster because we want them to understand what they're reading, but we want them to be able to read smoother because that's kind of the bridge, the reading experts will say, that once it becomes automatic, that automaticity, you don't have to think about what you're reading anymore. Now you can concentrate more on what the words say and the meaning. But you have to have that automaticity. If you're the bird, there's no way you're going to know what it means. So we got to get kids reading fluently so they can build that comprehension in there.
How is the AR program working? Is it helping kids that are good readers become better readers, or is it helping more the kids that are not good readers become better readers?
Well, ideally it helps all kids.
Right, or is it helping everybody?
It should help everybody. It should, if kids are picking books at their instructional reading level, it should give them, the goal is that it helps them practice reading and then comprehending, and then teachers get the overall score, so they can see, and we do what's called a STAR assessment too, a couple times during the year to see instructional reading levels and if kids have grown. But when you put that all together, it supports the reading in that it encourages kids to read outside. And there are pros and cons to AR reading, just like there are to any other program. But the bottom line is, if we just were telling kids, just go ahead and read, and we hope you're going to read, it wasn't happening. So AR, you know, they have to test. They have to. The test shows their computation or comprehension proficiency level, and teachers can use that as one more piece of data. I mean, the tests are pretty factual, so
well, but there is
they aren't total comprehension,
right.
But
there,
it's a base.
There is some back-end information for accelerated reader that I think sometimes goes into the line.
That's true.
Where the teacher's not only getting overall reading level, for example, I mean, the company that created AR, Renaissance Learning, they also, as part of the system, they provide information where you can break down some skills. They say, okay, if your kid's reading at this level, here's the skills they've mastered, here's what they're working on, etc. So it gives you some guidance in terms of what's the next piece to work on in terms of, you know, the reading piece. It's not just that you're reading at this level, but you're reading at this level, and here's what to work on to move to the next level. right? And I think that probably most teachers in the district haven't really tapped into that piece as much. So one thing you guys can do is start asking your teachers, you know, what is the AR, how are you using those AI scores, not just for tracking overall reading proficiency, but to actually move kids to the next place? Like, what kind of skill information are you getting from the program, and how are you acting upon that, et cetera? And I don't think we've probably done enough in that area yet, but Woodland's not, you know, unique. I think most schools are.
And you can easily run a TOPS report.
At the PTA, we're really trying to figure out how to get parents involved. We're in a small little group here, and I'm not usually seeing a lot of minority families involved, and you want a lot of your family to be doing something at home and working at home. And just thinking about some of the social events and things we do throughout the year, there aren't really money makers, people stand up, but there's supposed to be gathering in the community. Could we do something with more of an academic focus? Maybe have a family math night where the parents are coming and learning with their kids, through their kids, learning some of the math games and stuff. So all those ideas that come home on paper from teachers, some families, some of us here probably, are doing them at home, and others aren't taking that.
This is the choir.
Yeah,
it really is. I mean, you guys are the choir.
But I'm just trying to figure out how we can get every family to be more involved at home. That's always the issue. But just to throw out an idea, some kind of event that's more academic focused that would maybe give some of the parents the skills to do some of those things at home. I don't want to make more work for the teachers either, but
I know our schools are something like that, and they always pair up right to their music concert. So an hour before, they have like pizza and math activities, and then they go right to the music concert. So it's one night of out and whatever, and they've had a really good time. They've had bingo for books.
It's too hard. Our Scholastic Book Fair is on a conference night. Otherwise, if you had a book fair tied to and day after, and we're going to have some group reading or whatever, at like different grade levels or something.
But there's some great games. Even at Barnes & Noble, that's like a big game. There's some great games. The kids absolutely loved going from station to station. And,
I bought several of them for enrichment.
And the getting the stickers on their card, and Haley won them.
She did.
Yeah.
Well, the other piece I think is the website. I think if people really go to our website, you pay for the webmaster, which is Rajan, and she does so much work to provide links for the basic skills. I worry about a night to work on math. We'd have to find a purpose and make sure teachers felt comfortable. I would be good at helping kids. I'm not sure I could explain the math program probably, but you know what I mean? Making sure that that's a doable project. But it might be.
Just sitting down and playing some different math games. But you can do it home.
Or even for blackjack.
That's something that I can put in a flyer to encourage people to go to the links on there.
Yes.
We could have a little something when we don't have 8-quarter sheets and we only have 7-quarter sheets and we need to fill the last one. We can do that. Here's an activity to do with your kids. Teach a card game on here and have little card game instructors. If people get it to me, I will get that out. But not going to come up with all those, but I think can encourage them to use the website and have a reminder that if you go to our website, we've got links for math, fun games, and whatever.
I taught in Charlotte, Mecklenburg, North Carolina, which is a school system about twice the size of Minneapolis. And my middle school was 90% minority, 90% free lunch. And we struggled with parent involvement issues, and it wasn't really until we actually went to those communities, went to those neighborhoods, we went to those parents, and we started asking them, what are the best ways to connect with you? What are the best ways to communicate with you? What are the problems with current ways that we connect and communicate with you? And things started improving, right? So, I mean, you guys can have, I think, all of the extra activities that you want, but I think you're going to still see the same people, I think. If you thought about the percentage of involvement of low-achieving families versus the percentage of involvement of high-achieving families, you're going to see dramatic differences. But it's hard as members of the high-achieving group to figure out what to do to get the low-achieving group involved unless you go talk to them.
How did you reach that?
We started doing PTA meetings in the housing projects in the community centers. We started rescheduling parent-teacher conferences at times when people who work second and third shift could attend. We started, you know, communicating in different languages if necessary. You know, I mean, there was, we started, you know, working with community groups to tighten those connections. You know, we started hitting churches and other, you know, faith-based institutions that were tightly integrated with those communities. I mean, there's lots of different strategies, and I don't know what the best ones are for this area. But bottom line is, those people can tell you best how to communicate with themselves if you can figure out what the right questions to ask are.
The other thing we've talked about as a staff is sometimes you can't always change parent behavior, but we could do some things in school. Like one of the things we've talked about, and it's also big. You know, you've got to work on this and this and try to bring in this. I don't know how much we can do at one time, but one thing PTA might even talk about and think about is we have the A honor roll and we have the B honor roll, and then we have the honor roll for those kids that are showing extra effort. But we don't, and we have like fifth grade takes the kids to Nick and Willie's, but we don't really have a strong incentive for those non-proficient kids to move to the next level to become proficient. And I don't know if there's an award, I don't know if there's a some kind of incentive, you know, because those A honor roll kids, they get it and they can make it and it's motivating for them to get it or stay on it versus those non-proficient have never tasted it. They don't, and they've kind of shut down some of them because they know they can never get it. So why even try? So are there some, with RIT score, growth things PTA could say, you know what, if you hit this much growth working with me or...
Right. But it needs to be shorter term to be motivating. Because kids can't hold a goal in their head for an entire year.
No.
Right, they need, you know, like...
Yeah.
Do we have like a, like the sixth graders who are doing very well, or even the fifth graders, like a tutoring thing that they could help out some of the first and second graders or whatever, something like that where like at lunch hour instead of them going out on recess, they could read with the first grader who's struggling or something like that?
We don't at this time. We've talked about it, and that'll be one of the things I volunteer coordinator, but if you know a parent that would like to coordinate it,
okay.
We would love to start things like that.
Okay.
And part of that is having the staff supervision to be there, too.
Okay.
You know, so that piece is something that...
But if they even met in the library, isn't there a librarian here all the
some
time?
Some of the
would that be like a... No.
But you can't take away the first and second graders, or whatever age group it is, recess, if they're those
vulnerable. No, the sixth graders.
Yeah, but you'd be doing
who they're working with.
If you were doing it during... for extra help for a first or second grader, you couldn't do it during their recess time because I can tell you those kids need that break and they need that outlet they need to.
Well, you don't want to punish.
Right.
I'm the non-proficient kid, so I don't get recess. You want to do it the other way. If the proficient fifth grader can help and it works out where their lunch coincides with a lower grade, they would go down into that classroom where they could pull kids out and listen to them out in the hallway. But then there's that other side of the coin. If they're non-proficient, how much do you pull them out of in regular instruction? So there's finding that time.
Oh.
Well, and that's something that the district is working on. That was part of the DeFore.
It's overwhelming.
Yeah. Part of the DeFore presentation was, you know, that schools have been pulling kids when they're not doing well in math. You pull them and they get extra help on that, but then they're missing the current stuff in there. And so I think that's one thing the district is looking at is how can we do major restructuring of the district. And there was talk, I don't know if you guys heard about it down here, about adding a half hour onto the school day as structured study time so those kids who really need it, because, again, with that same issue, if you offer after school help for those kids, the kids who really need it aren't the kids who are able to do it and they don't stay after. You have to get it during the school day. Without pulling them, you have to restructure the school day.
Well, and instead of doing pull-out, we do push-up. So, we get time out, but I do my 30 minutes of instruction, and then they come in the last half hour of math, and then my title kids go to that table, and then I circulate my kids, and then she works with those title kids. Mm-hmm.
Title one is the key there.
The DuFours talk about the fact that we've got three things happening. We've got time, support, and learning. So the traditional model has been, okay, well, we have fixed amounts of time. We've got 35 minutes a day that we're spending reading, for example. And we've got fixed levels of support. There's a teacher, maybe we have a teacher's aide. That's pretty much all you get. And what they talk about is that because kids learn at different paces, right, at different rates and in different ways, when you hold those two constant, learning becomes the variable. Right? Because some kids are going to get it with that amount of time and that amount of support, some kids aren't. Now, making the shift to an idea where we say every kid must master this. This is an essential skill. Every kid must learn this. Learning is required. Learning can't be variable. Learning will be fixed. And what do we have to adjust? We have to adjust either time or support or both. Right? So some kids are going to need additional time to get to that level. Some kids need additional support. Some are going to need both. The bottom line is the focus doesn't become we only have 35 minutes a day of these resources. Focus then becomes every kid will get this, what is it going to take to get them there? And that's the shift the schools are trying to make, and that's the district-wide push that's starting to occur, is a radical rethinking around this, so that rather than saying, well, we only had 60% of our kids at proficiency level this year, how much time did you spend on reading 35 minutes? Oh, so what are you going to do differently next year? Nothing, it's still going to be 35 minutes. You start saying, for the kids who need it, how do we find ways to find more time? How do we find ways for additional support? Because this is what we're all about. Not holding the standard and hope we get this. This is what we're all about. What do we do up here to make it happen? And that's the shift that we're seeing in the district right now.
And the DuPont talked about that 30 minutes, you would do reteaching for some and then you do enrichment. So everybody would be in a learning situation.
Right.
But the kids that need it, the reteaching would be getting that, and the kids that didn't need it would still be in a learning situation. They might be doing junior grade books, they might be doing, but you also have to structure that skill time. I don't know if you guys remember being in elementary school, but I remember teaching, and I did it wrong many 20 some years ago, because you bring your little kids up and you skill them to death too. It's boring.
So you've got to open their minds and challenge them and give them some of those other strategies.
And one of the things I liked the way that DeForest talked about last Friday was this idea that it's not really reteaching, it's teaching differently, right? Because most teachers give it their best shot the first time, right? You know, like I said, they don't really hold back their best strategies for later. They're putting forth their best approach for the most kids. So when the kids aren't successful, then we've got to do something different, not more of the same, to get those kids to a different place. And of course, teachers need training and help figuring out what that is. It's awfully complex.
And that's where part of this, you weren't here, and I understand you even have something, and maybe it's the same thing, but we're piloting Turning Point, which is the quick response. And
I have Turning Point.
Yeah,
I have it.
We have three systems, we have one system here right now that we're, and we get half price for 32 units if we buy them by the end of the year, which means next Wednesday. So I said to Pete, the board, teachers are loving it. Kids are coming up to me in the hall and saying, please, Mrs. Burnham, buy Turning Point for us.
Yes.
So I asked PTA, we're going to write a grant, but I also asked if I'm going to put forth the building funds. We don't really have them, but I'm going to put them out. It'll be like $2,700, and then hopefully $1,800 of that, either the grant or PTA will back us on that road. But if you weren't here, Turning Point is like, the way I equate it is to Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. No, not Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. Is that the one?
Yeah.
Where they can go to the audience. I don't know what those are called, but Extra Life or whatever. They can go to the audience and they poll the audience as to is it A, B, C, or D. And they get an immediate response and it tells how many what percentage picked each one. Teachers can do that with this Turning Point and get an immediate response. They'll know how the kids are doing. They'll know who knows it and who doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, the powerful thing about student response systems like Turning Point that it gives you the instant window into who's getting it and who doesn't, right? You don't have to wait for them to turn in a piece of paper, and you take it home and grade it, and you come back the next day. I mean, you literally get it on the fly. You teach them for 5 minutes, you throw out 3 questions, okay, we still don't have it, or, you know, too many of you still don't have it, let's try that again in a different way. You know, I mean, it just gives you instant...
Anything.
It's anything. It's a multiple choice clicker, so it's got buttons like 1 through 10, A through G.
Yes, no.
So, yep, and it integrates...
Specifically,
right? You can, because you can assign clickers to kids.
Okay.
If you want. So you can tell exactly who's getting it, who's not. You can print reports over time, whatever. But the beauty of it is that it's happening real time in class. Because when you just ask a question of kids, you'll hear from 2 or 3 of them, and you won't hear from the other 25. But this, you hear from all 30 simultaneously.
And think about your college classes. If you were just quiet, if you didn't really know
Absolutely.
It, you could kind of sit back, and the professor would probably think that you could nod and look like
Absolutely.
You got it. A lot of kids are really good at faking it.
I remember biology going.
So knowing this turning point, because it seems to be cool and it seems to be relevant, but does it hit the bigger goal? I mean, if we're looking back, and Linda's back here next year, in or AYP or whatever those acronyms you guys, you know, is turning point the one of the strategies for this objective? I mean, or is it just because it's cool and the kids are playing with buttons and we can dissect and...
It all depends on the quality of the questions, right? I mean, the idea behind the monthly assessments is that to get you more frequent information and more detailed information on the kids about how they're doing as they go through the year.
What Turning Point does is it lets
you get a window even closer, so then rather than waiting once a month,
right.
you can literally find out in class
right
how they're doing. Or you don't even have to wait a day to go grade something. You can get it in class on the spot. But that means you have to ask good questions, right, that get at the heart of the core instructional learning goals that you're trying to achieve. You just ask them questions.
Is that part of the program? Is that upon the teacher?
No, that's upon the teacher.
That's game time. That's a real-time decision that he or she has to make.
It's the teacher's decision on what questions to ask and what the answers are,
etc. Is there support? Some sort of a support program for the teachers to help them
ask?
Turning Point just provides the system.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so there's
so internally would have to be the dialogue about what's a good question.
So they would have to.
And they meet every week in professional learning communities, and they talk about, they're called formative assessments because they're kind of like dipsticking to see if the kids are getting there instead of waiting till the end. And they do create, they're creating formative assessments now, but they're paper pencil kinds of things. And so they have to give them, get it back. They have to put it into a template and graph it. This way they get it back, and they could meet at lunch and say, how'd your kids do on that? Five point or 3 point. Okay, we had to reteach it. We can't go on tomorrow because we had too many not get it. Or it could be, I'm going to take them on. Scott, you take the kids that didn't get them. I'll kind of do an activity with the kids that did, and you reteach it, and then we'll move on. You know, so they've got, like Scott said, that real-time data to use.
Right. If they ask good questions and if they use it.
Linda, what was the amount then that you were asking from PTA?
Not enough.
It was $900, I believe. I don't have it right on the top of my head, but I think it was $900 for 32 sets.
For one,
and we want three.
This seems like a no-brainer in a way. Well, I mean, if we give somebody X amount of dollars for snowshoes, I mean, I hate to say that. Snowshoes are great, but...
We'll be undermining our efforts here.
You know what I'm saying? And we're getting the money back from the snowshoes, right?
I mean,
we're getting half of it back.
Yeah, so that's $1,000.
$1,000.
Pretty much taken
care of. I don't know.
Well, we needed some people out there looking for grants so we can get 10 of these babies, not just trying to find out how we're going to cut other stuff. We need some people. So who's up for grants?
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Well,
it's
good.
He's amazing.
It's the year. I can't.
Wouldn't he be, huh?
Oh, my gosh.
I would say.
You. We do grants at the U.
But actually, as a school community, I'm going to say this publicly, we owe Scott a lot. This building, I mean, professionally, I've grown. In fact, sometimes when I see him, I fight because he pushes me beyond sometimes what I think I can handle. But, he really has been a huge supporter for the teachers and our school and student achievement.
Your child's in what grade?
third and first.
Excellent. We're going to be here for a minute.
So, it's fun. I get to try out stuff, too. So.
I thank you for coming in.
Oh, my pleasure.
Invitation.
So, my pleasure.
Yeah, this was great. Thank
so,
you. Very eye-opening.
Thank you.
And in English. I mean, that makes sense.
Am I allowed to throw a bomb into all this?
Go for it.
Oh,
well,
hello.
You didn't approve it ahead of time, but I trust you.
This week's cover article in Time Magazine talks about preparing kids for the future rather than the past.
And what then was it?
No,
no.
I won't say it.
No, but I encourage you to get a hold of that article. If Linda permits, I'll put a link. And just think about the skills that we're testing versus the skills that kids need to function in the new economy are very different. So I work a lot with schools with data-driven decision-making stuff. Over 24 districts now in Minnesota, 3 state departments of ed. Everybody's trying very hard to get 100% of kids proficient on literally what are old skills.
Sure, exactly.
Not the skills that are necessary for the new technology-suffused, globally interconnected world.
But remember, we have district-adapted curriculum.
That's
we
right.
Can't veer from that. So, yes, we need that information, and it's good information, but it's like turning a ship in a little port.
Absolutely,
we
right.
Can't all of a sudden, we're just getting the teachers to, not just, we're ahead of the game, but we're looking at becoming a professional learning community, which means collaboration based on student achievement, looking at results. And we can't all of a sudden say, okay, now what you're teaching, but we have to start thinking about that.
Right, we have to start having those conversations.
Yes.
And now
that's
is a particularly good time
about.
Because the district is working on a strategic plan. So I encourage you to get a hold of that article. It does a really nice job of laying out where we are now and where we need to get to.
Is it hitting the newsstands this week?
It's out today.
Oh!
And it's literally cover story of time. Can't miss it. After you read that, you know, think about dropping somebody a note, just in terms of saying, you know, are we talking about these things as part of the district strategic plan, right? And so as we try to look ahead to the needs of our kids in the future, it's one thing to get everybody up to snuff on stuff that used to be successful in the old economy. It's another thing to start talking about where should we really be heading. And so, Linda, trust me, she let me throw this bomb in here, but I'm concerned that we're working very hard on the wrong stuff. And most of you, after reading that article, will probably agree with me. Wow.
And I would tell you that the Strategic Planning Committee is meeting Thursday, Friday, Saturday. They're being sequestered this week. Rajan Brown, and I'm not telling you to email her. Rajan Brown is representing us and our philosophy. Yeah. Rajan's phenomenal, and I'm so glad there are only 30 people on the committee, and she represents a diverse look. I mean, she really stands up for kids of color and all kids. But if you're going to impact the strategic plan, it's probably going to happen tomorrow.
You could email the superintendent.
You could always email the superintendent.
That's exactly right. Susan Hinn,
she's way open
the superintendent,
to that.
Yep, she's always got stuff. Send me information. What do you think? What do you want happening? She had those community cafes for the public to come in and say, this is what I want for my kids. I don't want this in our school system. And all of that information has been taken in and compiled. But jeepers, for all those opportunities, the show of parents, it was pretty heartbreaking, actually. You know, but there are opportunities. Or write to her. She's got a district email. She's got the, what's that newsletter thing that she puts out? I can't even remember the name of it, but she puts out all that information. And she can funnel that information into the school board, to the strategic plan. You know, I mean, there's a place for us to have a voice.
She truly does want to hear from parents.
There's a place for us, yes. Uh-huh.
But as Linda noted, they're meeting this week for their big, huge retreat. So if you want to hit them on this issue, you got to move quick. So how to move our schools out of the 20th century. It's the article. Anyway, just something to think about.
Thank you. I'm going to go home and read it.
So, you know I like to throw parties from time to time, Scott.
Yeah, I do know that.
I was wondering if I could guarantee a certain amount of people that would be worth your while. Could you come and do something like that?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean,
you'd do that?
I put in as much volunteer time here as I can.
Because I could...
It could be wherever you want.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure I could get together a bunch of people.
I'm guessing you probably could.
Serve them alcohol afterwards. No, but yes, I think I could, and I think this is so worthwhile getting out there that, man.
I'd be willing to
I think I can. I think if you get a few people, it'll spread.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think.
Well, and I think I know enough diverse amount of people that go here that I'm friends with that I think we could, like you said, it would spread, I think.
Mm-hmm. We need some more diversity coming to the meeting. We've lost that. We have 200 families who are Asian, or Asian Island Pacific, or Pacific, so that would be awesome. That would be interesting to find a way to involve them as well as our black.
Well, we had that, like, cultural night, and she went nowhere.
Yeah.
Well, and it's also a cultural night.
For their culture. It's not really a... But something we've talked about is next year, you know.